palms braced on the top. Before he could ask, Grifoni said,
"I told her I admired her for being so clever and for knowing how to keep a secret. Then I said that I envied her for having found a way to save money, because I had the same passion for cosmetics and loved to use the best. I put on my unhappy face and said how hard it was with what I earned to afford them."
Brunetti listened, as fascinated as a python by the snake charmer's flute.
"Then I smiled and gave her some more compliments, and she looked at me for a long time, and then asked me if I took medicine. For a minute I didn't know what she was talking about, but I said yes, tried to look modest, and said I did take something for a feminine problem."
Smiling at her own cleverness, she added,
"Even women are reluctant to ask you anything once you say that."
Brunetti smiled and shook his head at the same time.
"She said she might be able to help me, but she had to think about it."
"If she chooses to remember," Brunetti said before he thought.
"Don't be unpleasant, Guido."
"Sorry. What did you say?"
"That there's nothing I'd enjoy more. Then she invited me to come for tea," Grifoni explained, smiling. "And she suggested that perhaps I could bring some pastries for her and Beata."
Ah, how much his mother would have admired both of these women, he thought. "And when?"
"Next Monday at 3:00.
Grifoni pushed herself away from the railing and started down the steps.
Chapter 21. As they passed in front of the church, Grifoni said,
"I wonder why she dislikes her so much."
"Could you untangle the pronouns?" Brunetti asked.
"Why Professoressa Crosera dislikes Signora Gasparini so much? She's a helpless old woman who's putting up a good fight against bad health and declining powers and not being in control of her life anymore."
"Those are reasons to pity a person, Claudia, not to make you like them," Brunetti said, knowing even as he spoke how sententious he sounded.
"Ever heard of jealousy?"
Grifoni asked, laughing.
"Or possessiveness?"
"Her husband spends his work week in Verona," Brunetti shot back. "And when he comes back to Venice, she hears that his aunt is nagging at him to come and visit her, and to help her with this or that."
Before she could interrupt, Brunetti went on.
"It makes sense that his wife would think the old woman was repetitive, insistent, and forgetful."
At this, Grifoni stopped walking, swung around, and all but blocked his way.
"All right, she's all these things. But she's his aunt, for God's sake."
Her voice had grown louder with the last words, and Brunetti noticed a young woman turning to look at them. Just as Brunetti was thinking how much she sounded like a southerner, with talk of the sacred family, Grifoni added, her voice suddenly low and almost icy,
"Besides, you've seen the apartment. Top floor, facing the Church of the Carmine, at least 250 square meters. View of the canal, view of the garden behind."
To Brunetti, she sounded exactly like every shifty estate agent he'd ever known.
"And who do you think is going to inherit that, Guido?"
Now she sounded like every shifty Venetian estate agent he'd ever known, seeing all human affairs through the lens of location and size. But he decided it would be unwise to remark on this. Instead, recalling the way the older woman had ignored Grifoni when they met, he asked,
"You've certainly warmed towards her. Why the change?"
"Because she's tough,"
Grifoni said without hesitation.
"And because when I suggested you and I were a couple but not married, she didn't mind at all, the way many people her age still pretend to. She also liked it that I'm not Venetian."
"Why is that important?"
"Because I don't have preconceptions about the people here. And that means I'll listen to her opinions, without adding something about the way that person's great-grandfather's brother cheated the cousin of my great-grandfather out of 20 acres of land in Dolo in 1937.
Brunetti laughed, diffusing the situation, and said,
"You've been paying attention to us, haven't you?"
Returning his smile, Grifoni said,
"You're not so different from us. Although Neapolitans usually go back more than 5 or 6 generations to find the reasons we give for having a strong opinion, even a positive one, about someone." After a moment's thought, she added, "Strangely enough, most of what she said was in favor of people, about how she liked or trusted them."
"Did she mention anyone in particular?"
"Oh, she had a list. Her sainted Uncle Marco, her doctor, her friend Anna Marcolin, 2 cheese sellers at the Rialto, and Signora Lamon, who lives on the floor below her."
Grifoni paused in thought until the memory came.
"The man with the mustache who sells fish in Campo Santa Margherita."
In response to Brunetti's glance, she explained,
"She's heard talk that he sometimes sells fish left over from the day before, but she said she could guarantee that this is not true. Her family's bought fish from his family for 60 years.
Laughing again, Brunetti said,
"That's certain proof she's one of us."
Grifoni responded,
"It would make her one of us, too."
Peace restored, they continued on their way.
"The person at the top of the list is the pharmacist, Dr. Donato."
In response to Brunetti's blank look, she said,
"He's the owner of the Farmacia della Fontana, the one that issued the coupons. His name's printed at the bottom of the coupon, along with the tax number, address, and phone number."
"What did she tell you?"
"That he's a descendant of a doge who ruled in the 17th century for 35 days, and she's proud to be his client."
Grifoni let out a puff of disbelief.
"I know we're title crazy in Naples, but it's nothing like the way people here carry on."
"Maybe it's the little hats the doges wore," Brunetti suggested, straight-faced.
She stopped, looked at him, and laughed.
"This is the first time I've had the Venetian not go all buggy-eyed and fall on the ground in fits at the mention of the doges. Are you sure you're really Venetian?"
Switching to the most impenetrable pronunciation and using the dialect he remembered from his grandparents, Brunetti said,
"Noi altri semo sente che no se lassemo sturcar le segole in te ioci."
"What's that mean?"
she asked.
"Roughly, it means that we don't let ourselves be fooled by anyone."
He watched as she tried to repeat it in her memory and translate it into Italian, and failed.
"It could mean anything as far as I'm concerned," she said.
He was pleased she hadn't understood. Some parts of the city still hadn't been given away. His own children spoke Italian more easily than Veneziano, probably because he and Paola spoke Italian with them. That hadn't stopped them, however, from learning Veneziano from their classmates. Brunetti pulled his attention back to Signora Gasparini and asked,
"Did she say anything else about the pharmacist?"
"She's been going to him for a few years, so he's probably diagnosed her as many times as her doctor has."
With no warning, the clouds parted, and Campo Santa Margherita was flooded with sun. The temperature soared.
"Let's sit for a minute,"
Grifoni said, moving towards one of the long benches in the campo. Grifoni sat, folded her arms, and stretched out her legs. Brunetti joined her, half turned towards her, 2 friends stopping for a chat.
"I have 2 aunts,
she said, looking at her feet and not at Brunetti.
"With Alzheimer's. Well, the beginnings of. And they both jump from subject to subject with no preparation and no logic. First it's fish, and then it's the rail system, or their children, and then the chewing gum on the streets. If I want to talk to them about something, I have to keep herding them back to, for example, the chewing gum. They concentrate for half a minute, and we can talk, but then they're on to Mexico or Lourdes. So I have to ask them again about the chewing gum, and then they can talk about it some more. But then they start asking if I've decided what I want to study in university, or where I bought my sweater. By the time I mention chewing gum again, they've forgotten we'd talked about it. And? Brunetti inquired.
Signora Gasparini is hardly as far gone as my aunt's, but she used their technique, and it might have been to avoid talking about him. I asked about Dottor Donato, and she asked where I got my shoes. I told her I got them at San Leonardo, right opposite the pharmacy, and that made her tell me that the ex Cinema Italia in San Leonardo is now a supermarket, and we had to talk about that for a while. That's how it went, like billiards, things always going off at crazy angles, and sometimes returning to where we started, but only if I found a way to drag her back. She spoke of him with admiration and gratitude, but there was something else in her tone.
Grifoni pulled her legs in and crossed her knees, then started to wave her right foot up and down in the air.
"I got the impression," she said, her foot continuing to move, "that she was suspicious of him but afraid to confess it, even to herself."
She unfolded her arms and placed her palms to either side of her on the bench. After a moment she pushed herself to her feet and said,
"That's enough for today. I'll go back now. We can talk later."
She turned in the direction of Campo San Barnaba and the closest Vaporetto stop, and was quickly absorbed by the crowd of people, once unusual at this time of year, moving in that direction. Instead of starting for home, Brunetti went into a bar and ordered a coffee. While he waited for it to come, he called Signorina Elettra, gave her Dottor Donato's name, and asked her to see what she could find out about him. She asked if there was anything else he'd like, and hung up when he said that was all. He went to the cash register and asked to pay for his coffee, and was surprised when he was told it was €1.20. He paid without questioning the price, but out in the calle he found himself wondering if he had been cheated, or if the price had been allowed to rise since yesterday, when he'd paid €1.10. "Are we really that venal?" Brunetti asked himself, and started walking in the direction of Campo San Barnaba. His family, it seemed to him in retrospect, had combined poverty with generosity, but perhaps memory was adorning his parents' behavior. He remembered a succession of men described as friends of his father who had often eaten with them, and recalled that his own clothing, after he'd worn it for 2 or 3 years, often disappeared from his wardrobe after a visit from a cousin of his mother, who lived in Castello with her 6 children and perpetually unemployed husband. Brunetti's had been a family that had nothing, but could always find something amidst that nothing to give to someone who had more nothing.
"And who's more Venetian than we are?" he asked the air in a soft voice,
much to the surprise of a woman who was walking past him in the campo. He turned right after the Accademia, and then left, and into the pharmacy on the first corner. Standing behind the counter was his former classmate and first fidanzata, Beatrice Rossi. She saw him come in and smiled at the sight of him, as she had each time they'd met over the years.
"Well, look who's here," she exclaimed, apparently addressing the same air he had spoken to in the campo.
She came from behind the counter and they embraced. 2 happily married people who had thought years ago, decades ago, that this might be their common destiny. He looked at her face, and behind the wrinkles at the sides of her mouth and eyes,
saw the sweet-smelling girl who had come, the first day of Liceo, to sit next to him in history class.
"Still chasing bad guys?"
It was by now her formulaic question.
"Still selling drugs?"
was his.
"Do you have time for a coffee?"
Brunetti asked, knowing that after so many years in the pharmacy she pretty much came and went as she pleased.
"No, I can't, Guido. Lucilla's sick, so the only one here with me is the girl, and she can't make up prescriptions."
She looked around.
"No one's here. We can talk."
Over the years, Beatrice had occasionally provided information to Brunetti about the people in her area, sometimes those she knew as clients. She never discussed their medical information, nor anything they might have told her in confidence, but once or twice she had repeated gossip when Brunetti assured her that the information was necessary to him.
"Who is it this time?"
she asked with easy familiarity. When she saw his surprise at her directness, she smiled and said,
"I see that hunter's gleam in your eyes, Guido."
Rather than protest, Brunetti smiled in return and said,
"Dottor Donato, your colleague."
Beatrice's mouth opened involuntarily.
"Oh, my,"
she said.
"Why ever would you bother with someone like him?"
"His name came up in another matter, and I'd like to know more about him before we bother to spend any more time taking a careful look."
This might not have been the whole truth, but it was true.
"How did it come up?"
she asked.
"Oh, someone mentioned him," Brunetti answered.
Beatrice burst into laughter.
"Next thing you'll be refusing to tell me Paola's name,"
she said, and laughed again, this time at her own remark. Brunetti pressed his lips together and raised his eyebrows in something close to embarrassment.
All right, Beatrice. The truth is, I'd rather not say. I just want to have a feel of the man."
"Give me a hint,"
she said. At first he thought she was joking, but then he realized what good sense she had. She had no business talking about Donato's sexual preferences if his children were involved in stealing cars on the mainland. Nor should she reveal that he beat his wife, nor that his wife beat him. It took Brunetti some time to find a way to explain what he wanted to know.
"Would he bend rules to increase his profits?"
A woman about Brunetti's age came in and walked to the counter. Beatrice retreated behind it and asked if she could help her. The woman turned to look at Brunetti, but he directed his attention to the contents of a bottle of shampoo, and was amazed by the number of substances inside, and curious about why so many were needed. The women conversed in low voices, and Beatrice went into the back of the pharmacy to emerge after a few minutes with four boxes of medicine. She took the boxes, peeled off stamps from the backs, and pasted them onto the prescriptions the woman gave her. Then she ran the prescriptions over the sensor plate next to the cash register, put the boxes in a plastic bag, and accepted a 20-euro note in payment. She rang up the sale and returned the woman's change, added the receipt, thanked her, and wished her a pleasant evening. When the woman was gone, Beatrice came over to stand opposite Brunetti.
"Dottor Donato is one of the most respected pharmacists in the city, Guido. He was once the president of the Ordine dei Farmacisti."
Brunetti waited. When she said no more, he insisted,
"Now, tell me what you don't want to tell me."
Silence.
"Please, Beatrice, it might be important."
Still not a lie, but Brunetti nevertheless felt uncomfortable saying it.
"Well,"
she began, and turned to straighten a display of cough drops.
"There are some people who'd probably say yes to your question. It doesn't matter who they are.
She seemed to have concluded. But then she smiled at Brunetti and leaned close, as if about to tell a secret, and said,
"There's no need to bend the rules. We earn more than enough as it is."
"May I write that out and ask you to sign it?" Brunetti asked.
"Good God, no!"
she exclaimed, and raised her hand in mock horror.
"They'd expel me from the Order of Pharmacists if that got back to them."
"It's good to hear one of you at least admit it," Brunetti said with sudden seriousness.
"We all have too much, Guido. Not just pharmacists. All of us. Too much money and too much stuff, and never happy with what we have."
Brunetti looked across at this new person, wondering if he had heard her correctly.
"Do you really mean that, Beatrice?"
"With all my heart," she said seriously. "I'd give it all away if I could."
She smiled suddenly.
"Well, half of it, or part of it."
Her smile grew.
"I'm such a hypocrite. Don't pay any attention to me."
"But you meant it, didn't you?" Brunetti asked. "At least while you were saying it."
"Probably,"
she said hesitantly. And then more forcefully,
"Yes. The only trouble is that I can't keep meaning it. It comes over me once in a while when I see all the things we have, Rolando and I, and all the things the kids have, but then I forget about it."
She shook her head.
"Pretend I didn't say that, all right?"
Brunetti shook his head.
"No. I want to remember it. It's one of the best things I've ever heard you say."
He leaned forward and kissed her on both cheeks and left the pharmacy, not looking back from the door because he didn't want to meet her glance. Chapter 22. As Brunetti walked towards home, he thought about what Beatrice had said.
Probably.
How interpret that? She'd heard talk, but that was hardly material on which to build a case against a man. Some people believed Dottor Donato would bend the rules to increase his profit. The legal profession called this hearsay evidence, a kind of linguistic alchemy that tried to transmute gossip into something more credible. He recalled that Beatrice had spent 2 years at university studying to be a notary, and then had surprised her friends and family, her father was a notary, by abandoning it and switching to pharmacia. At the time, the best explanation she could give was that she wanted to do something that would help people, an answer which failed to satisfy her family. Thinking of notaries, he recalled the farcical scene when he and Paola had bought their apartment. More than 20 years before. The notary, just at the moment when the bank check was to change hands, remembered something he had to do in some other room and left the buyer to pass it to the sellers. No sooner had the door closed behind him than Brunetti opened his briefcase and pulled from it packs of lire. Ah, who thought of the lire now? Dear little lire. He'd passed the stacks to the sellers, a young couple who had decided to move to Vicenza, and they'd started to count their way through the stacks of notes. At one point the notary had knocked on the door and called from outside to ask if they were finished. They'd all joined in calling out, "No!" The seller even shouting, "Don't come in!" an order the notary obeyed. When the 100 million lire was all counted and resting in a different briefcase, Brunetti pulled out a bank check for 100 million lire less than the real price of the apartment, put it on the table, and called to summon the notary back to his own office. Ah, where were the lire of yesteryear? Now there were bank transfers and a general atmosphere of distrust between buyers and sellers, for the state was no longer willing to tolerate a system that would prevent it from collecting the full tax revenue due on every sale. Unfortunately, it had not yet devised a system that would prevent that money from disappearing into the black hole of government malfeasance. This memory forced Brunetti to consider how contradictory were his own ideas of fiscal rectitude, at least when dealing with the state. He paused at the top of the bridge leading to San Polo to consider the possibility that the coupons might be part of a system designed to cheat the state and not the customer. Were that the case, there would certainly be less, perhaps no, desire to report it, should signs of it be noticed. People cared if the state cheated them, not if someone cheated the state. It was no subject to discuss at dinner, so instead he listened to Chiara praise her history teacher and the way she managed to interest her students in the events they read about, currently those of the first centuries of the Roman Republic. For the first time, Chiara had begun to think about how vastly different people in the past were from her.
"They could kill their children if they wanted to," she said,
horrified at the right of a Roman father to destroy a child he did not acknowledge or want.
"From what she said, it sounds as if you could just go to the nearest garbage pile and pick up a baby if it was still living and take it home." "And do what with it?"
Rafi looked up from his plate to ask.
"Raise it as your child,"
Chiara answered. Rafi, showing that he had learned a thing or two about timing from his mother, added,
"Or your slave."
Ignoring him, Chiara looked across at her father, who was helping himself to more gnocchetti di zucca. With an easy smile, she pounced on him.
"I'm afraid you would have been out of a job, Papa."
"Really? Why?" asked Brunetti, although he knew.
"There were no police,"
Chiara declared.
"Think of it. 1 million people in the city and no cops."
She left it to everyone at the table to consider this and then asked,
"What did people do if something bad happened to them?"
"Your teacher hasn't talked about that yet?" Brunetti asked.
Chiara, who was taking a sip of water, shook her head.
"I think she'll tell you that your only recourse was to hire a lawyer, someone like Cicero, to make an accusation, or, if someone accused you of something, to hire a lawyer to defend you."
"But what if you couldn't afford to hire a lawyer?" she asked. "Papa, you read about this stuff all the time. What happened? What did people do?"
Hoping to remind her of what she'd begun by saying, that people back then were very different, he said,
"Most people didn't think that way, Angel. Either you put up with what happened to you, or you took matters into your own hands."
"What does that mean?"
Chiara asked, making no attempt to disguise her incomprehension.
"The same as it does today," Paola interrupted. "You punished the person who caused you the trouble, whatever it was, or you hired someone to do it for you."
"But that's crazy,"
Chiara said.
"People can't live like that."
Brunetti longed to say that many people in her own country still did, but kindness moved him to silence, and he gave her no reply. He shot a glance at Paola, who stopped herself from saying whatever it was she was preparing to say, and instead said,
"Chiara, I made that ciambella you like so much."
The reality of dessert could still haul Chiara back from the thought of social justice. Then she asked,
"The one with raisins and pumpkins?"
Paola nodded.
"It's on the windowsill. Should be cooled down by now. If you bring it, I'll get the plates."
That said, Paola got to her feet and started collecting their empty dishes. As she reached across to pick up Brunetti's, she gave him a nod and a broad, fake, tooth-filled smile, and then followed her daughter into the kitchen. Later, as they lay side by side, reading in bed, Paola turned to ask him,
"Is that the right number Chiara had?"
"Of people in Rome?"
"Yes."
"It's the number I've read,"
Brunetti said, turning Antigone face down on his stomach, even though he was impatient to continue reading. It seemed the only time he had for serious reading was before he went to sleep. It was a bad idea, of course, because he was usually so tired he fell asleep quickly, but it was the only time in the day when claim was not made on his attention, and he could at least try to concentrate on what he read. Paola did the same with her book. He didn't know what she was reading, and folded her hands on top of it.
"A million people living without law," she said, and closed her eyes as if better to imagine it.
"It's almost impossible to believe," Brunetti said.
She turned to him and smiled.
"I'm glad you stopped me."
She reached across and put her hand on his arm.
"From getting up on your soapbox?"
"Yes, and saying something incendiary, like, 'And now 60 million of us do.'"
"More polemical than incendiary," Brunetti observed dryly. "Chiara wouldn't have listened anyway. No one cares about it anymore, especially young people."
"It?
Politics."
She turned her head and studied his face.
"We have 2 children, Guido."
"Are you expecting me to say something solemn, like, 'Someone has to try'?"
She closed her book and set it on the table beside her. After enough time to give his question serious thought, she said,
"The man I married would say it."
"Antigone said it, and she ended up hanging herself in a cave," Brunetti replied.
"The man I married would say it," she repeated.
Brunetti turned his book back over, but left it flat on his stomach. He looked in the direction of a painting on the wall between the 2 windows, hard to see clearly in the penumbra of light that reached it. It was a small 17th-century portrait of a Venetian man, quite possibly a merchant, that Paola had found in a junk shop. She'd had it restored and given it to him for their 20th wedding anniversary. The man, sober in dress and expression, looked directly at the viewer, as if assessing his worth. On a table to his right stood a dark green vase of what looked like gladioli, which Paola had explained were the symbol of honor and constancy. Brunetti looked at the man and imagined that the man could look at him. The light beside the bed would give him a better view.
"Yes, he would have," Brunetti finally agreed.
He picked up his book and continued reading, eager again, after a gap of 20 years, to listen to what Antigone had to say about the obligation to follow the law. How refreshing that would be to a man who had spent the last 20 years dealing with people whose only interest was to outwit the law. Paola turned to the other side and switched off her light. The next afternoon, when Brunetti went to Signorina Elettra's office, he sensed the tension the instant he walked in, even before he saw Lieutenant Scarpa standing in front of her. His weight, supported by his hands propped on the desk, he was leaning forward, his neck seemingly strangely elongated to bring his face closer to hers.
"Or am I mistaken, Signorina?" Brunetti heard him ask.
Signorina Elettra turned towards Brunetti, but not before he'd seen the emotions on her face, scorn, anger, and perhaps even fear. Her face changed when she saw Brunetti, and she said, too brightly,
"Why don't we ask the commissario, Lieutenant? He's certainly more likely to know something about this than I am."
"What is it, Signorina?" Brunetti asked,
acknowledging Scarpa's presence with a nod that managed to seem polite. Scarpa pushed himself upright, waving one hand upwards in a balletic acknowledgment of Brunetti's superior rank.
"Signorina Elettra and I were trying to think of a way that certain privileged information might have escaped the boundaries of the Questura," the lieutenant answered.
He smiled at Signorina Elettra, as though asking her approval of the explanation he had just given.
"I see,"
Brunetti said, making himself sound completely uninterested in the matter. He saw Signorina Elettra's face relax minimally at his tone, and so he continued.
And the pharmacist?
There's nothing that's very interesting, Signore, I'm sorry to say.
Brunetti's family had had a nondescript dog when he was a kid, and because it was his duty to take it for walks, he had learned what each backward glance, each tug of the leash meant. So he knew, from her voice, that she was tugging at the leash and wanted very much to move along from where they were. Thinking he'd give her the chance, Brunetti said, in the voice a superior used with a junior,
"Thank you, Signorina. I found a few things yesterday and made some notes. Perhaps you could come up and get them and add them to your report."
It was weak, and it was obvious that it was ostensibly a request from a superior to an inferior, so she had no choice but to push herself up from her chair, saying,
"Ah, good. Then I can finish it, commissario, and ask the vice questore to take a look."
As if Patta cared about reading reports, Brunetti said to himself while holding the door of her office open for her. He did not feel comfortable leaving Scarpa alone in her office, so he waited, looking across at Scarpa, making it obvious that he was expecting the lieutenant to leave with them. Scarpa must have realized he had no choice and joined them at the door, taking Brunetti's nod as permission to pass in front of them, which he did. Brunetti closed the door after them. He and Signorina Elettra started up towards his office. Behind them, Lieutenant Scarpa walked to the end of the corridor and turned left. In his office, Brunetti went to his desk and leaned back against it.
"Do you want to tell me what he's talking about?"
he asked mildly. He watched her consider and then discard the idea of asking what he meant.
"He's talked about it before, commissario. You've probably heard him."
"These leaks?" She nodded. "Do you know what they are?" Brunetti asked.
"He says that the name of someone who was called in for questioning has been divulged."
"Divulged to whom?"
"He didn't say. Just that the name of a suspect's been released."
"How?"
"He didn't say," she repeated.
"Is that all?" he asked.
"The lieutenant seems to think it's more than enough."
"To do what?"
"Accuse someone, I suppose. He likes to do that."
"I've noticed," Brunetti said. "Do you know anything about it?"
She raised her chin and pressed her lips together. All she needed to do was put her hands behind her back and rock back and forward to look like a nervous child caught at something she'd been forbidden to do.
"Yes,"
she finally said.
"Is it something I should know about?" Brunetti asked.
After what seemed a long time, she said,
"Not yet."
Brunetti chose not to comment on her answer and said instead,
"Is it possible to get a list of the patients registered at Dottor Donato's pharmacy?"
"I should think so. Well, at least a list of the people whose prescriptions have been filled there."
"Have a look, then, if you would," Brunetti said.
"And what they're being prescribed." "Are you looking for any particular kind of medicine, or disease?" she asked,
giving Brunetti an idea of the categories of information she might be able to open up to him.
"Anything expensive that's prescribed for older people."
He saw curiosity flash across her face and added,
"Especially if they're being treated for something that might affect their memory or their mental powers."
She nodded.
"Can you do this?" he asked.
She looked at him, but quickly lowered her eyes in modesty, as though unwilling to engage in something as unseemly as boasting.
"I have access to a wide variety of information, signore,"
she finally said. Brunetti was about to ask about this, but caution stopped him. It would be better if he didn't know the full extent of her powers. He put his hand to his mouth and turned the question into a cough. When that stopped, he put on a serious face and, turning to her, said, "I hoped you might." Chapter 23 Soon after Signorina Elettra left, Vianello tapped lightly at Brunetti's door and entered without waiting to be told to do so. Brunetti waved him to his usual seat and asked, "Did you see Signorina Elettra on your way up?"
"No,"
Vianello answered, then surprised him by adding,
"That's what I came to talk about."
"Signorina Elettra?"
"Yes,"
the inspector replied, then added,
"And what's bothering her?"
"From what I've seen, it looks like Lieutenant Scarpa is."
Vianello raised his hands and stared at his palms for a moment, then said,
"Yes, it does seem that way, I know."
"Does that mean it's really something else?"
"Sort of,"
Vianello answered. Brunetti took a long breath and released it slowly.
"Can you tell me what's going on without talking in secret code?"
"It's confusing, Guido,"
Vianello said. Brunetti remained silent, so the inspector went on.
"One of my informants told me weeks ago he'd heard there was someone here who named the suspect we let go for lack of evidence, even though we knew he was guilty."
Vianello raised his hand and pressed gently in Brunetti's direction to indicate that he wasn't finished.
"When I asked him about it, what man, what crime, he didn't know anything and said he'd heard someone talk about it in a bar."
Vianello pursed his mouth and shot up his eyebrows to express his skepticism.
"I told him I wasn't interested and to forget about it. But then, a week ago,"
the inspector continued, his voice suddenly more serious,
"he told me he'd heard the same story again, though this time the name of the man we let go had been mentioned."
Brunetti reached across his desk and put his fingers on a mechanical pencil. He picked it up and clicked the eraser a few times until the thin lead emerged. He studied it for a moment, then pressed the eraser down and held it while he pressed the lead back into the pencil with the tip of his finger. He glanced up from this and across at Vianello.
"Who?"
he asked.
"Costantino Belli."
Brunetti's eyes widened. He set the pencil down.
"Where is he?" "The last I heard, about 2 weeks ago, he was out of the hospital and at home. Well, at his mother's home."
"Ah, the mother,"
Brunetti said. Vianello crossed his legs and swung his foot back and forth.
"I don't know if I should say this, but we have no sure proof that he did anything."
"No sure proof," Brunetti repeated. "But we can infer the truth."
Vianello hesitated just an instant before he said,
"Judges don't convict people because of inferences, Guido. They prefer facts."
Brunetti smiled.
"Haven't I warned you about using sarcasm, Lorenzo? All it does is make people angry."
"Sorry,"
Vianello said.
"I lost my head for a moment."
"Lucia Arditi was in the hospital for 3 days after she was attacked,"
Brunetti said, voice tight.
"The doctors said she'd been raped and burned with a cigarette. This happened in her own apartment, in her own bed."
He heard his tone lurching towards outrage and paused until he felt able to continue.
"Lorenzo, you read what the ambulance crew said when they were there. She told them she'd been raped."
"She changed that later and said that it was consensual,"
Vianello said immediately, sounding not unlike a defense attorney.
"Whose side are you on?" Brunetti asked him.
Vianello folded his arms across his chest and stared across at him. Eventually, Brunetti said,
"I'm sorry, Lorenzo."
Vianello shrugged.
"He's a vicious little shit, Guido. You know that, and I know that. We know it because of what he did to Lucia Arditi. And we know there's no doubt that he did it.
Vianello waited until Brunetti nodded in agreement and then continued.
But a magistrate would say it's only what we believe he did to Lucia Arditi, who has said he did not attack her.
Vianello gave Brunetti the opportunity to protest, and when he did not, the inspector continued.
And then the magistrate would say that, in the face of her repeated testimony and the absence of any real evidence, there is no way he could even think of making a case against Belli.
When Brunetti didn't contest this, either, Vianello went on.
She said they'd had sex that evening, and that's what she told her Facebook friends, remember?
Vianello's voice changed subtly as he quoted,
"For old time's sake."
His glance met Brunetti's.
"You read it, Guido. She told them all, after telling them that Costantino was in the shower, how right she had been to break it off with him."
Vianello paused after that, almost as though he wanted to give himself and Brunetti, people of a different generation, time to try to understand that a person could write such a thing and want it to be public information.
"When she got to the hospital," Brunetti began, "it doesn't matter what the doctor thought or what she said when she was admitted, Guido. In her statement to us, she said it was consensual."
Brunetti opened his mouth to speak, but Vianello cut him short.
"All that matters is what she said and continues to say. He left, she went to sleep, and when she woke up she noticed blood on the sheets, so she called 118 and they sent an ambulance." "The cigarette burn?" Brunetti demanded. "She insisted it was an accident," Vianello said in a tight voice. "His mother's message?" Brunetti asked,
but there was no real curiosity in his voice. This question had been resolved some time ago.
"You read that too, Guido. She sent the girl an SMS to wish her a quick recovery and tell her Costantino's friends were eager to see the videos he'd made."
Vianello held up a monitory hand and added,
"Signorina Elettra had no authorization to look into her telephone server. We are in possession of that information illegally." "It's useless anyway," Brunetti conceded, although reluctantly. "The old cow didn't say what kind of videos they were. If we asked her, she'd probably say they were videos of Costantino's first communion."
He got to his feet and walked over to the window, looked across the canal to the far side, saw nothing there that helped calm him down, and went back to his chair.
"Is it because we have daughters?" he asked Vianello. "It's because we're human," the inspector said.
Brunetti pulled himself away from speculation and asked,
"Did the second man who was talking actually use Belli's name?"
Vianello nodded again.
"Yes. They were talking about what happened to him. A few of them laughed and said a good beating was probably what he deserved. And then one said he'd heard that someone at the Questura had said he was the man brought in for questioning about what happened to Lucia Arditi."
He paused to let Brunetti comment or ask questions. When he did not, the inspector went on.
"He's looking for me to pay him something before he remembers who told him."
"What are you going to do?"
"That's what I came up to ask you about."
"What do you think?" Brunetti asked him.
Vianello quickly uncrossed his arms.
"I think it would be better to let it drop. Tell him I don't believe him and that we're not interested."
"Before, it sounded as though you were interested," Brunetti remarked neutrally.
"Think about it, Guido,"
Vianello said in a mild voice.
"I have been," Brunetti said.
Their eyes met. Brunetti pulled his lips together and took two deep breaths, but said nothing. They both knew that Signorina Elettra had read the report of the ambulance crew and what Lucia Arditi had originally told them, a story she had later retracted, just as they both knew that Elettra had been the one to find Belli's mother's SMS to Lucia Arditi. No wonder Vianello wanted to tell his informant that they didn't believe the story about a leak from the Questura.
"Oh my, oh my, oh my," Brunetti whispered to himself.
He addressed his attention to the wall and thought about what he did and did not know about Signorina Elettra. He stared at nothing for a long time and knew he and Vianello were right. Breaking what he believed a taboo about a parent's interest in his child's sexuality, Brunetti offered a silent prayer to the protector of young people and begged that Chiara's first lover be a good boy who loved her. He didn't have to be intelligent or rich or handsome or possessed of prince-like qualities. It would be enough for him to be a good boy who loved Chiara. Brunetti leaned forward and keyed Belli's name into his computer, searching for the report from the hospital he had never bothered to read. The young man, who had been found on the street, had been admitted to the emergency ward at 1:30 in the morning, more than 3 months before. His face had been repeatedly struck, his nose broken and the cartilage badly torn. He had apparently been kicked in the groin. One testicle was severely bruised. His left shoulder had been dislocated, though there was no sign of a bruise that would suggest it had resulted from a fall. Brunetti glanced away from the computer and recalled the police involvement in the attack. They had not been informed until the morning after, when a call came from the hospital. Belli, who had regained consciousness, said that he had been walking home when suddenly he heard footsteps behind him, and then he remembered nothing until he woke in the hospital. The presence of his wallet in his back pocket argued against a mugging, but it was not until Brunetti saw Belli's name that he began to suspect that the attack was linked to the rape of Lucia Arditi, more than half a year earlier. A discreet check on her family revealed that her parents, who owned a shoe factory outside Treviso, had been in Milan for an industrial fair on the evening that Belli was attacked, while the girl and her brother were visiting an uncle who lived in Spain. The policeman who interviewed him had asked Belli if there were any people who might have wanted to do him harm, and he replied that he had no enemies. The case rested there, neither forgotten nor pursued. Brunetti remembered thinking that a lot of time had passed since the rape of Lucia Arditi. Vengeance, the adage said, was a dish best served cold, but it didn't happen that way in the real world. Vengeance lacked patience and was usually quick, impulsive, and stupidly obvious. The person or persons who had attacked Belli, and Brunetti reminded himself that he was assuming vengeance was the cause, would probably have had a more recent reason to attack him. His own experience with people whose business was violence told him that professionals would have done a far better job of it. Belli would have become familiar with pain and with the walls of his hospital room. His legs would have been in casts, and he would not have gone home to mummy after only 2 days. For some reason he recalled the way Signorina Elettra had kept her distance from any mention of the possible leaks from the Questura, when she ordinarily would have fallen upon such a rumor with hungry curiosity. He recalled her awkwardness, one might even say nervousness, in front of Lieutenant Scarpa. Finally accepting what he had tried to ignore, the expression on Signorina Elettra's face, and admitting that it had in fact been fear, Brunetti got to his feet and went to do what he did not want to do.
Signorina Elettra smiled at his arrival.
"Is there something I can do for you, Commissario?"
she asked. And he heard, for the first time in all these years, or forced himself to hear,
timidity hiding in her question. He smiled in response and consciously relaxed his shoulders as he approached her desk. Then, realizing he was too close, he turned aside and went over to her window to admire the flowers, the ones with the heads that seemed to be made out of hundreds of narrow petals. He couldn't remember their name. He moved to the next window and leaned back against the sill.
"And the pharmacist?"
he asked, another delaying tactic. She seemed relieved by his question. Her face came alive, and she turned to her computer.
"Yes,"
she said, sounding pleased, but not at all relaxed. She reached forward and tapped a few keys, then invited him to take a look.
"It's the geography that's confusing," she said.
"What does that mean?"
Brunetti asked, all thought of Belli, Scarpa, and Lucia Arditi pushed to the back of his mind. He moved to stand beside her and looked where her finger was pointing to a vertical list of names arranged in alphabetical order.
"These are Dottor Donato's clients who are more than 70 years old."
Before he could count them, she said,
"There are 127.
She hit another key, and the same list appeared again with two new columns to the right of the names.
"This shows the medicines they're each taking and the disease the medicine is usually prescribed for."
Brunetti saw that many of them were taking the same two medicines, and most of these were prescribed for the same two diseases, Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. Before he could ask what she saw on the lists that he did not, she said,
"Let me show you the geography."
A shorter list appeared. Brunetti estimated 50 names. A second column was headed kilometers, and a third, Vaporetto stops. Brunetti studied the page for some time and noticed that more than half of the names had a rating, or so he construed it to be, of at least 4 kilometers, and all of those listed at least 7 Vaporetto stops. Signorina Elettra looked up at him and smiled.
"Let me add this, signore,"
she said, and struck a single key. The same shorter list appeared, but this time a fourth column, address, had been added. Roughly half of the people on the list, one of whom was Signora Gasparini, lived in Dorsoduro, while most of the others lived in Castello. Brunetti stared at the list, looked down at Signorina Elettra, and said,
"Even though Dottor Donato's pharmacy is in Canareggio."
"And all of these people are older than 70, some of them more than 80, and most have to travel or send someone halfway across the city to pick up their prescriptions."
"That doesn't make any sense, does it?" Brunetti asked.
"Not unless they're getting something special at Dottor Donato's pharmacy," she said.
"Or he's getting something special from them," Brunetti suggested.
In response to her smile, he asked,
"How did you see this?"
"My family lived in Canareggio when I was growing up, near San Leonardo, and I remember we lived at number 1400, so when I saw his address I knew it had to be up there, almost at Ponte della Guglia, and nowhere near Rialto. People from Dorsoduro wouldn't go there, much less people from Castello. Not to go to a pharmacy, at any rate. Now look at this, signore."
She raised her right hand, fingers suspended above the keyboard, and held it there for a second, like a pianist, pausing until all noise in the audience stopped. She lowered it slowly and tapped out 3 notes, click, 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 then sat back to allow Brunetti to see the screen. This time only 2 lists, the patients, again in alphabetical order, and the name of their doctor. This list, however, had no need of alphabetical order, for there was only 1 name— Dottore Carlo Ruberti, with 2 offices, one in Dorsoduro and 1 in Castello. She allowed Brunetti time to absorb the significance of what he had just seen.
"Don't worry, commissario. I've printed it all out for you."
When she saw that his expression didn't change, Signorina Elettra said,
"What is it, signore?"
He took a step away from her and, pointing in the direction of the computer, said,
"I didn't come to